Hello, my name is James Ledbetter. I am the editor in charge of Reuters.com, and I'm interviewing today David Callahan. David is the author of a recently published book called Fortunes of Change: The Rise of the Liberal Rich and the Remaking of America. David, you want to say hello?
Hi there, I'm David Callahan. I'm a senior fellow at Demos, which is a think tank in New York City.
Which is properly pronounced Demos, at least in the UK where it originated. David, why don't you start us off just by describing for those who haven't read it the basic thesis and topic of your book?
So my book looks at the shift in political ideology among the upper class. And the argument of the book is that as we've moved from a manufacturing to a knowledge economy, the composition of the upper class has changed, and their politics have as well. So you have many more people who now have a lot of money in this country who have made that money, in effect, by parlaying their education into success, whether in technology or the more sophisticated parts of finance or entertainment, the law, medicine. In many ways, what's happened is that the creative class, as Richard Florida has used the term, has gotten rich over the last decade or two, particularly the last, 15 years. And that has brought a lot of new kinds of people into the upper class. A lot of people who were born in blue state America, grew up in very liberal metro areas, New York, Boston, Los Angeles, the Bay Area, Seattle, went to pretty liberal elite colleges and universities, and have made their money and work and live in blue state America, and have many of the kind of the political outlooks and values that you often associate with that kind of demographic. So that's pretty much the overall thesis of the book.
David, I'm getting some static on your line. Is it is your mic moving around or anything?
No, and in any case, the audio is not. They don't use the audio from the phone. They use the audio from the computer.
Right. Okay. Okay. I hope maybe they'll cut that part. Anyway, it seems to have subsided. So this is an interesting area to look at because this is obviously the trajectory of our overall economy over the last half century as well. The number of people who make their living in manufacturing gets smaller and smaller. The number of people in service sector or, as you say, kind of creative class, intellectual property, grows and grows, and this is the real driver of the American economy in a way that it simply was not half a century ago when we were still much more industrial based, much more based on extraction companies, parlaying natural resources, and that, if I understand you correctly, accounts for at least some of this political difference. The fact that in our parents' generation, it was almost a given that if you made a lot of money, you probably were conservative at a minimum. That you voted Republican, you supported political parties and political candidates who took, quote, pro-business, unquote, positions, which often meant sort of anti-labor positions, and this has all changed.
Yeah, and you can see that, in those old, in the old economy, in a manufacturing, if you were in a manufacturing business, 30 or 40 years ago, or even today, you found yourself as basically the white collar supervisor of blue collar workers, and sort of pitted against unions. If you were in the extractive industries, you found yourself dealing with government regulation. And I think that the nature of being an old economy industries is likely to make you more conservative just because of those sorts of situations. In contrast, if you're in the knowledge economy, you're less likely to be in constant fights with labor unions or be coming up against federal regulators in the environmental area or labor area in quite the same way.
And so, you know, I think this part of your argument is very interesting and sort of relatively, from my point of view, uncontroversial, but nonetheless fascinating. And I think one of the ways that you flesh it out that's so interesting is to look at these sort of pockets of really concentrated wealth, where again, you know, kind of thinking about it from 10,000 feet above, we would think, okay, these places would be conservative, and some of them are even in red states. Can you talk a little bit about these sort of pockets of liberalism?
Yeah, well, basically, almost every place where you find the biggest concentrations of wealth are often pretty liberal cities. I mean, New York City is, of course, famously liberal city. That you have some of the biggest fortunes here. The Bay Area, a very liberal place. Until recently, though, the Bay Area was not such a hugely wealthy place. You know, we tend to forget that all of this technology money is really, you know, 10 or 15 years old in terms of the true and present scope of it. Lots of new money in Silicon Valley. The entertainment industry, you know, Hollywood was always a pretty liberal place, but what's happened is that thanks to globalization, there's been a huge injection of new wealth into the entertainment sector, and a number of new billionaires in that area who also happen to be big Democratic donors like Steven Spielberg and David Geffen, George Lucas. The Pacific Northwest is another place where, you know, Pacific Northwest was often liberal. You know, Seattle was sort of a liberal city in many respects, and now it's a place sort of saturated with millionaires and new money. And then there's smaller pockets, places like Austin, Texas, you know, long famously one of the most liberal cities in Texas, if not the most liberal city in Texas, now with a lot of new money. Boulder, Colorado, you know, some other smaller examples.
And so a place where the thesis gets, from my point of view, a little trickier is that you say, you know, not only has this phenomenon been going on, that the wealthy are sort of moving further to the left in terms of where they give their money, how they vote, the causes that they choose to underwrite, but you also say it's happening against a backdrop where the Democratic Party itself stands further to the left than it has. You would complete the sentence because it's your thesis. But can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I argue that, you know, what many people have long said is that the wealthy, to the extent that they're attracted to Democrats, it's because the Democrats have become so centrist and don't represent any real difference with Republicans.
This would be roughly where I come in, but go ahead.
Right. Yeah, and you wouldn't be alone in that perspective. What I suggest or show in my book is that in a number of ways the Democratic Party has actually in the 10 years moved to the left, and that you can see that in certain ways. One is kind of the decline of the DLC, which, you know, used to be such a central player in the Democratic Party, kind of replaced by if you look at the influence of the Netroots, which has become much more powerful, you know, I point in 2007 to the fact that not a single of the Democratic Party candidates for president went to the DLC's annual conference in 2007. All of them showed up at the Daily Cause conference. And a real sort of shift of gravity away from the DLC. Another indication of the Democratic Party's movement to the left has been, you know, the various gauges of roll call votes. The Americans for Democratic Action have been tracking the so-called liberal quotient of the Democratic Party, of all members of Congress, actually, for 50 years, and reports that the liberal quotient of Democrats was higher in 2007-2008 than ever before during its tracking period. As well, the roll call data by Howard Rosenthal and Poole, I'm forgetting his last name, shows a sort of clear shift, leftward shift of the Democratic Party over the past 40 years. And one thing that's happened, of course, is the Democratic Party has lost many of its southern members, you know, because of the realignment. So just as sort of kind of overall, by some overall indicators, the Democratic Party has certainly shifted to the left.
So we'll let that argument stand for the moment, but I just want to try and get at something that you address in the book, which I guess I would call sort of the agency problem or the self-interest problem. If it's in fact the case that the party is moving to the left and the rich are moving toward the party and or the left, you have to sort of have some kind of explanation for why this group of very wealthy people is acting in a way that would appear to be at odds with their own economic interests. And you do address this, but I think it's sort of a glaring issue for anyone coming to this argument from the outside.
Yeah, and it's the what's the matter with Connecticut question.
Right.
You know, like, why would people vote for a Democratic Party that wants to raise its taxes, raise their taxes, you know? And actually, that's one of the notable things of the Democratic candidates for president, both 2004, 2008, you know, clear, strong emphasis on raising taxes on the rich. And Obama particularly not only endorsed raising taxes on the rich as a candidate, but as a senator, co-sponsored legislation to more than double taxes on hedge fund managers and also those people in private equity and venture capital firms to close that loophole in that area. And yet Obama raised twice as much money from hedge fund managers as John McCain in 2008. So you have to wonder, well, what's going on there? And I have sort of two explanations for that. One is that some of these people are similar to values voters among the sort of white working class. You know, they care about their values, the social issues. You know, they're social liberals. They care about the environment, so they like the Democrats for that reason. The other explanation.
I would put abortion on that list as well, right? I mean, there are sort of people who, for kind of cultural political reasons, that are correlated to, as you say, sort of where they went to college, you know, it's just unpalatable for them to align themselves with pro-life Republicans, right? I think that's in the New England set, that seems to be a big divider.
Right, so those Planned Parent Republicans, many of them are now Democrats.
Right? Yeah, it's really true.
And generally, you know, the intense wariness of many of these educated, affluent people about the religiosity of the Republican Party, the evangelical Christians, and their moral agenda. We can come back to that issue of the GOP extremism, which is another driver here. But just sticking with the question, why do they, you know, would they go against their self-interest? And the second explanation I give in my book is that many of them define their self-interest differently. They're less interested in getting a tax cut tomorrow and more interested in making sure that this country is investing in the sorts of things that will produce prosperity in their industry and overall, you know, in the next decades to come. So By that definition, they're not so much voting against their or giving money against their self-interest. They think that some of these people, I think that they will be. It's better to pay higher taxes in a wealthier, more prosperous country than to pay lower taxes in a country that's less prosperous because it hasn't invested in education, infrastructure, scientific research.
Yeah, I think it's a really strong point, and that the, you know, somewhere along the line, we allowed our political system to blur the distinction between self-interest and selfishness, and they've been kind of elided and equated and therefore incredibly narrowly defined, right? You know, $150 more a year in lower taxes is supposed to determine my vote. And what you suggest is that, again, part and parcel of how these people have made their money, they are looking at a much bigger picture. You know, it seems equated in my mind to the reason that people like Bill Gates decide to tackle malaria in Africa, or why the Google guys are so committed to coming up with some kind of clean energy solution, because they are really thinking, to the extent that it's not a contradiction in terms, as business visionaries, right? What will the market look like 50 years from now?
Right.
Who is going to continue to buy our products? You know, it is self-interest. It is eleemosynary from one point of view, but it is also grounded in self-interest. And I think that's a really strong point.
Yeah, and just to also elaborate on your point, which is that, you know, you see a division among the upper class going back to the days of Andrew Carnegie, who famously wrote The Gospel of Wealth. And Carnegie argued over 100 years ago that people got rich because they live in a society that supports wealth creation, that you get rich because of a complex set of institutions that allow you to get rich. And there's always been a kind of rebuttal of that, which is the Horatio Alger, no, I got rich because of my own effort. You know, it's sort of the collective notion of wealth creation versus the individualistic notion of wealth creation. And what I argue in my book...
The only thing I can say there is that Horatio Alger never had to do business in Russia. Right? I mean, I think any sophisticated American business person who has tried to do business abroad, particularly outside of the context of, say, a highly regulated economy like the EU, or even in the EU, will come away with a newfound respect for things that heretofore were completely taken for granted, such as the rule of law, right? I mean, you have people in Russia who go to jail for doing things that are pretty routine, here in terms of setting up businesses, establishing markets, there have been a number of books written about the importance of just really simple things like property deeds. And how important that kind of stuff is to setting up a business and allowing it to grow. And those things are, you know, we take them for granted, but they are not necessarily a given in many countries outside the United States. And so globalization, you know, while its advocates portray it as this sort of frictionless extension of the Washington consensus or the American way of doing business, in practice it is something far different.
Yeah, and Warren Buffett, you know, has remarked that he feels that he owes a lot of his wealth to, you know, living in an American society, and said, you know, plop me down in some developing country and you'd see just how worthless my talent was.
Right. You know? I think it's a really good point.
Yeah, and so the thing is that a lot of the knowledge economy types who understand complexity and work in a very complex sort of wealth-creating ecosystem get this collectivist notion of wealth creation and tend to be more on that side of the debate than the libertarian side of the debate.
Very true. So let me ask you about the just recently passed elections, because certainly on the surface it would seem that the strong Republican gains made in both houses of Congress the very strong gains made in state houses and state legislatures. I think the state legislature numbers are, if not an all-time record, like a, the most powerful shift in a century or thereabouts. This would appear to either repudiate or put an upper limit on your thesis. What do you think about this election that just passed?
Well, it certainly shows that conservative wealthy are alive and well. And, yeah. I mean, we saw the mobilization of a lot of right-wing money in this election. The Koch brothers giving money to the Tea Party, Rupert Murdoch giving money to the Republican Governors Committee, and a number of other very wealthy. Bob Perry, the Texas home builder, giving over $7 million. So definitely that awakening of right-wing money, which as I say in my book, is definitely there. Meanwhile, some of that liberal money was on the sidelines. You did not have George Soros opening his checkbook in a big way. Peter Lewis, Herb and Marion Sandler, some of the other big donors sat this one out. But if you look at the campaign finance records, what you'll find is that the Democratic Party, you know, putting aside the outside groups, the Democratic Party raised as much money and spent as much money as the Republican Party,
right.
Which suggests to me that there's a lot of big checks still being written, by people with money for the Democratic Party, even after the alienation for sure of some people on Wall Street and in the banking area from Obama and the Democrats. There's still plenty of those wealthy donors who are willing to pony up a lot of money for this election.
But there seems to be therefore something incomplete about the thesis, right? So somebody is being a class traitor, either to the way that they are traditionally defined or to the way that you define them, right? I mean, if these hedge fund types who switched place, which a lot of them did, right? They were either, you know, not kind of voting their pocketbook before or not voting it now.
Yeah.
And I wonder which way you see it.
Well, I think that some of the wealthy who backed Obama were like other independent Americans who, you know, found Obama and the Democrats attractive and were in the Obama camp for that reason. But others are sort of more kind of long-term, and it's sort of that core of wealthy supporters that, you know, I've been more interested in my book. So if you look at the exit polling, you find that 35% of voters making over $200,000 voted for Democratic House candidates. That's a national aggregate figure. In the
35%.
So a third of Americans over $200,000 stuck with the Democrats in this election. Even though the Democrats, you know, the health care reform raises taxes on the Democrats, and, you know, clearly Obama and the health care reform raises taxes
on the wealthy,
and, you know, obviously the Democrats want to repeal those Bush tax cuts on the wealthy as soon as they can. So that didn't seem to phase that sort of core third of affluence who stuck with the Democrats. And then in some particular races, you see that Democrats actually won a majority of wealthy voters. So Richard Blumenthal in Connecticut won 55% of the over $200,000 vote. Andrew Cuomo in New York got his highest margin among voters making over $200,000. Cuomo won 70% of those affluent voters.
I mean, I guess I would say in both those cases, the driving factor may well have been fear of their opponents, right?
This is,
I think, one of the aspects of the 2008 election that, I mean, your book is filled with terrific analysis of the 2008 elections, but I did find myself wondering sometimes if this was not a kind of, you know, snapshot taken at the very moment that everything looked perfect, you know, whereas it was perhaps largely driven by the fact that for a long time John McCain was not considered to be a particularly strong candidate, an impression that was only reinforced when he appointed Sarah Palin to be his vice presidential candidate, and that a lot of people just said, oh my God, these people are never going to win. They don't deserve to win. Let's at least get on board with the Democrats because that's where the influence is going to be, at least through the next cycle.
Yeah.
So you saw, I mean, one thing that I wrote about during that election was the pharmaceutical industry, which has traditionally been very strongly Republican, because they want smoother pipelines for their drugs for a variety of regulatory reasons. They switched in 2008, and I think it's in part because they just could smell a loser. This time around, you know, money follows money, money follows the polls. Many of the Republicans looked stronger, but in those areas where they looked weak, like Connecticut, well, I mean, Connecticut was more of a toss-up. The New York race was really pretty clear-cut, even though you had a businessman running for office. So I just wonder if maybe it's not a little more situational than your thesis implies.
Well, there's definitely something to that. On the other hand, if you look at some of the trends, what you see is 2008 is sort of more a culmination or a high water mark.
Than it is
a fluke. And so, you know, the hedge fund money is a perfect example, which is the hedge fund money started going to the Democrats starting in 2000. So if you look, you know, 2000, it officially becomes a majority of the hedge fund money is going to Democrats. And then in 2002, 2004, 2006, that keeps climbing up. You know, Obama won 8 out of 10 of the most affluent counties in America. Kerry won 6 out of 10. Gore won, I think it was 4 or 5 out of 10, right? So I think that you will see, could see dips, but I believe that the long-term trajectory is going to be this continuation of the shift in the upper class political allegiances. One thing will certainly have a big effect is where the Republican Party goes. You know, if the Republican Party continues on its extremist trajectory, then a lot of these people are going to end up with the Democrats just because there's no place to go.
Absolutely, and I would add too that what happens to the next economy what happens to the overall economy over the next 2 years is sort of critical. I mean, if we continue to have unemployment above 9%, I think support for Obama, even with all of the advantages conferred upon an incumbent, is going to really suffer. Whereas if unemployment can come down, certainly the Republicans will try to take credit for it because it would happen after the midterm elections, but I think it historically provides a very strong basis for the re-election of an incumbent, which is a good preface to what I think should probably be our final question, and that is, where do you see this liberal upper class placing its bets in 2012? Is it will they go full guns for Obama's re-election? Will they turn their attention to critical Senate races? Are they going to get more involved on the state level, the way that George Soros has sometimes gotten involved in statewide initiatives? Where do you see the tea leaves pointing now that we've had this relatively dramatic midterm election result?
Yeah, it will depend upon how the economy goes. I do think that a lot of these people will be big supporters of Obama. Interestingly, a number of big liberal donors lost interest in Obama because he wasn't left enough. You know, they were disappointed in his centrism. So Obama's in a tricky situation. You know, he moves left, he loses some wealthy donors and gains others, and vice versa. But I think a lot of these people will sort of come back around to Obama, especially if the economy is growing, and especially if the Republicans nominate Sarah Palin. If, however, the Republican Party shows some signs of moderating, nominates a more technocratic candidate, maybe like Pawlenty from Minnesota, then that could be a very different situation.
Good. Well, we'll certainly keep an eye out for it. Thanks for a fascinating conversation. I've been talking to David Callahan, author of Fortunes of Change, The Rise of the Liberal Rich, and the Remaking of America. I'm going to hold up the book right there. Get it in the camera. Okay. And I'm James Ledbetter, and it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Jim.
Take care.
Good to be here.